podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm interviewing Matt Keon of 18 Feet and Rising, or at least he was of 18 Feet and Rising, now elsewhere. But this is part of my startup series where I've interviewed Mark Denton and Dave Dye, and I guess some past episodes, such as that of Dave Bonaguidi and Kate Stanners, and obviously Steph from Big Owls, also go into that, but I'm doing it kind of more deliberately now. So Matt started 18 Feet and Rising. We talk about his career and stuff and the bits before that for like 15, 20 minutes. And then we go into why 18 Feet came about, what some of the challenges were, some of the positive and negative experiences out of that happened to be. And we kind of see that, again, there are, every story is different, every story is unique. There are some common threads that kind of link all these experiences of beginning an ad agency. So without further ado, here's my chat with Matt. Thanks for making the time to have a little conversation on the podcast, Matt. It's very kind of you.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Cool. Well, I think it would be great to, because you're Australian and a lot of your great stuff was done in the UK, it'd be interesting to see how you started in advertising and how you made your way over to Britain and how that all happened.
Yeah, sure. It's quite a nice full circle story, actually. And that my kind of path is probably not that dissimilar to a lot of other people on your podcast, albeit the context has probably been a bit different. But I was, it's probably best to start how I got into it. I was never knew about advertising, never thought about it. My family had always been into politics, so that's kind of what I was going to do. So I signed up to university, but I didn't get the mark, so I was doing these kind of nothing's degrees, a communications degree where I could do politics and PR, strangely. And it was in one of those classes that there was an older guy, a mature age student, a guy by the name of Nicholas Radette, who had just come back from, I think it was OLMAP, BBDO in Brazil. And he'd worked there on placement for some time. And he was sitting in my class and he had a book that he was working on in between his spare time. And I just kind of asked him what he was doing, and then he kind of explained to me what a book was and that he had come to Sydney to do award school because someone said at OLMAP had said to him to do a course. And so that, which was probably like a poor man's Watford, if you like. I mean, back then it was pretty good. I think it's changed a lot now. But it was a three-month course where you got mentored by two agencies and two creatives from those agencies, and you also had classes once a week. So he really introduced me to that, and so I thought, oh, this seems really interesting. So I signed up for that. And at that time, I think they still do it, but if you got in the top 10 or 20 or something, you got a job or what would be similar to a placement, I think. So I did that. I got a couple of placements, I guess, and kind of just kind of went around town, you know, after that working for free or saying, asking people if I could work for free. And I got a job at a little place called Boo, which at that time had done, I don't know if you remember, there was an ad for Flick Pest Control where there was a little cockroach in a coffin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So they had, and that was at the time when, you know, the Lazer's archive was, you know, we would get it in Australia like 6 months later than everyone else, and shots reels would arrive on pneumatics, but again, you know, 6 months later. And so I just kind of fell into it. And at Boo, he kind of, Marcus, the guy that ran it, kind of just made you do a bit of everything. So you had to actually get your own business to work on your own ads. You had to do a bit of strategy, not that I knew that what that was then. And it was kind of like he just left you to become your own self, you know, fulfilling little mini agency within his agency. So I did that for about a year. And then another friend of mine who had got a job from a ward school, was at the biggest agency in Australia called George Patterson Bates. And he was leaving there to go somewhere else. And he said, oh, I can get your book in front of a guy called Matt McGrath, who had just taken over the creative department and just come back from working at Legas Delaney, actually. So I sent it there and he kind of liked it. And then I got a job there. And that was a very interesting department, you know, a very big department. And he was very much, you know, having just come back from the UK, very much about writing copy and, you know, doing things that way. He'd hired a few people from the UK who were really good. There were other really good people there, and they never really concentrated on kind of doing work to that standard or to win awards. So his big mission was to do that. So we did that, and I remember kind of, you know, just writing, trying to figure out what a good ad was, and never kind of getting there. And he was quite a good taskmaster. I guess, you know, obviously Tim rubbing off on him. And then there was a guy there, an art director called Dayan Razik, who I, you know, still remains a good friend, that we just started working on things in our spare time. Like, you know, there were so many briefs going through that place that you could literally just pick up one that no one wanted and try and do something. So we just started working on those kind of briefs that, you know, I know everyone knows this, but that everyone didn't want. And we thought, well, we'll do two versions. We'll do a version which we know the client will like, and then we'll try and push something, and maybe the odds will be in our favour. So we did that. We got a lot of stuff out. One, you know, I think, you know, Khan at that time was still quite respected on certain means, and Dayan won quite a lot of awards, and I think I got some finalists or something. And so that was that. And then we thought, well, you know, it's Sydney's small. What could be our next step? So we actually took 3 weeks off and flew over to the UK, actually, with our book and, you know, the old days of having a portfolio case, a big A2 one. And we just went and saw everyone we could. We saw Paul Silgan at Lohard Spink then. We saw people at BMP. We went to Added Mead. I think we saw Nick Worthington there. So we just saw everyone we could, and saw Dave Joga at Saatchi's. And we were just really hungry to get a job. We got off, saw Rooney Carruthers at WCRS. So everyone said we could, we got offered placements, but we kind of really didn't understand truly how they worked. And also because we'd been working a couple of years, we just weren't sure whether that was a backward step. And I even think the last week we were there, we ended up working in CDP for a week just because they said, oh, let's see what you can do. So we kind of flew back, and, you know, we didn't land anything. But we kept in touch with Dave Joga, and I think Dayan worked out he was going to be at the airport at a certain time. So we rang up the airport and did one of those things, you know, in the old days you used to do to try and get a job, one of those tricks. And we got them to announce something on the loudspeaker to him. I can't remember what it was. But then he sent us an email and said, look, why don't you go do some time in Singapore at Saatchi's there, and then if that works out, you might be able to come over to London. So that's what we did, and we moved over to Singapore. And at that time, Saatchi's was, they just, you know, had that run of kind of winning quite a lot of awards for things like Fiery Fries and,
oh, yeah,
you know, and I think the RSPCA. And that was another, you know, the thing about that place is you walked in with one book and you walked out with three. They just did so much print, you know, very heavily print, very, you know, the whole system was set up there just to kind of really concentrate on doing world-class print. So it was a really interesting experience. Sorry if I'm kind of rambling.
No, carry on. I mean, I was just going to say, which year was this? So we've got a bit of an idea.
So that would have been 1999.
Right.
98, 99, because we came back to Sydney in 2000, I believe, yeah. or just the mid part of 2000 when the Olympics were on. So it was, you know, good agency for the great people. Like I think Jagdish Ramakrishna was the CD there. There was a guy called Kelvin So who was very good. Yeah. You know, did a lot of work, and we learned quite a lot there. But there wasn't much TV. I mean, it was just print actually. I can't remember doing any TV while I was there. And you know, really, again, really talented people that I just kind of, you know, tried to learn as much as I could from. And at that point, we thought, oh, okay, what are we going to do? And Dayan actually got a job. He wanted to go to London, so he actually got a job at Grey under Tim Mellors. And then I thought, I'll go back to Sydney just for a bit and see what happens. So I just kind of messed around for about a year or so, and then Dayan, it wasn't working out at Grey, so he came back and we got a job at a place called BMF, which is Brown Mount Jewish Fish Stock. So Warren Brown and Paul Fishstock, again, all this, the UK influence, you know, they'd worked in the UK, and Warren had worked at BBH and done quite a lot of work on Levi's and was pretty well respected. And the same with Paul, you know, he was in the copywriter's book, and I think Paul was in the art director's book. I mean, Warren was in the art director's book. So they offered us a job. We took it, did quite well there. You know, kind of that was kind of in their startup phase. I think there were about 20 people when we joined, and then it just grew and grew very rapidly. But I don't know what it is with myself. I think I get bored very quickly, or once I feel like I've learned everything I can, I kind of think, well, what's the next thing? So after a couple of years, I thought, oh, you know, maybe I'll try doing my own thing. And at that time, they just hired a guy called Oliver Green, who literally just walked in, and I said to him, well, I'm thinking of doing my own thing, and he said, oh, you know, I'll come, just very spontaneously the second week he'd actually joined. So I thought that was, you know, we were very young and kind of naive, and, you know, that I thought that's all you needed to start an agency was just the yes and the energy.
Yeah.
So we did that, and it wasn't a success. There were a lot of learnings, but we did that for almost 3 years. And we thought, well, you know, let's make it more innovation. So, we do more innovation work for Mars or Coke or that, which is just an even more soul-destroying path. And then we thought, oh, okay, let's see if we could write something. And we wrote something, and, you know, it kind of got published, but it never took off. And then we thought we'll do other sorts of products. So it was kind of a mishmash of just our frustrations and our ideas and of trying to make something work. It didn't really work. So then after 3 years, we thought, you know, it was a good learning experience, but let's try and get over to the UK. So we came over to the UK, met a lot of people, showed our stuff around. And, you know, our stuff was never really, you know, it's not like we'd won tons of awards or were really well known. It was, you know, and I don't know, it was more kind of a mishmash of thoughts and things in our book. We really never took it as serious as perhaps we could have. But we ended up getting either an offer from both Al Young, so Al Young at St Luke's, and then Al Young at FCB at that time, who had kind of gone there to try and turn it around. So
yeah.
With a guy called David Bain and Jonathan Rigby. And they seemed quite good, so we thought, oh, we'll take the harder challenge because, you know, if it works, we'll look great. Even though I think culturally we probably felt like St Luke's was more of a cultural fit for the type of things we wanted to do. So we went there, and it you know, it's that old chestnut that it immediately became apparent it was going to be very hard to do anything there just because of the culture. The people there were great, you know, this, and I remember that the people were still in offices then, and more than that, they were still smoking in offices when we joined. And we'd come from Australia where, you know, that stuff had been banned for a very long time. So I thought that was quite hilarious. And we tried really hard, like, you know, but I think anyone that's ever tried to do that turn the place around thing kind of knows that inherently if the culture and the systems and just the history of the place is not focused on perhaps what we would call you know, good work, then it's almost an impossible project. So I was getting quite frustrated. So I just said to Ollie, look, maybe we just need to have a break and go our separate ways. So I think he went to Lowe, and at that time I knew a couple of people at Fallon, so Micah Walker, and they said, oh, look, there's something might be going here. Why don't you send your book through? So I sent it through and then met Rich and Andy, and they offered me a job, and I just thought, you know, it'd be silly not to take it. So, I took it, and so Ollie went to Lowe, and then I went to Fallon. And then that kind of was probably the first time I'd really taken the job of advertising really seriously, I think, just because there was so much, you know, the onus was that you kind of had to do that when you were there.
Did you feel like you were at, because I mean, I guess you knew what was good and who was good at that point, and suddenly, you know, there's Richard Flinton and Andy McLeod's place, and they'd obviously had a really good reputation up till then. Did you feel this was finally a place that would, you know, bring the best out of you, or you were going to learn a lot from those guys?
Yeah, I was hoping. Yeah, exactly. I think that's really right. I think I was hoping that I would find something about myself or the stuff that I was doing that I kind of didn't know. Is that, you know what I mean? That, you know, in the company of, I mean, there's just so many good people at that time in that department, even then, that, you know, that I would have said then definitely had more better work than myself. So I was definitely hoping that would rub off on me, but also I'd find my, I mean, a lot of it, the great thing about Fallon is it allowed me and Rich in the end is, you know, everyone's got a certain, I guess, style, and that it allows you to kind of find your own voice and then kind of pursue that. And they kind of supported that. So, you know, that was the great thing about that place, and then watching it grow as well. So yeah, I mean, it was just such a, I mean, there's so much to probably to talk about that. I don't, should I?
Yeah. Go into the Fallon time a bit. I think that'd be good.
Well, I think going back to our original point, what was fascinating for me was, you know, after, you know, there's so much there. The first thing I walked on literally straight away, which they gave me, was a pitch for More Than. And, you know, I was kind of shitting myself because they, you know, back then also they kind of liked just having lots of individuals around. I mean, they had teams, you know, as well, but they also had, you know, obviously Juan, but they had Thomas Mankowski, who's now director. They had these floating people. So they just, I don't know whether it was intentional, but they just test these people every now and then and I guess give them something big and see what happened. And, you know, I was working on that, and, you know, I didn't really know how they worked then either, so I just had some stuff literally stuck on the wall. And then Rich came around one day and just looked at it, and then he just saw something and just went, oh, that's it, isn't it? And you're kind of like, what? Well, I don't know. I don't even know what that is yet. He goes, no, you just got to, you know, that's it, isn't it? You just got to do that. And, you know, if you look at this thing from 1962 and you get that tone, you just put that on there and, you might just want to do that, and then that's it. Yeah, that's going to win it, isn't it? And that, you know, it probably sounds quite flippant, but he knew exactly kind of what he wanted you to do, and then you kind of had to put the pieces together between that. And I think I know a lot of people. I know Chris and John kind of alighted on that a bit. He'd say these things, and you know, it'd confuse a lot of people. But then once you unlock the code, so to speak, it just made your work a lot better. And, you know, we pitched that thing and it won. And then I just thought, oh God, like I'd never really experienced that kind of, you know, direction, I guess. And then, you know, a year later, you know, to be working, you know, he got, I think Rich and Andy got Dave Dye in, and then, you know, he was sitting on the desk across me, and then we're working on stuff. And, you know, I remember, I'm sure Dave won't remember this, but I was texting my friends going, you know, working with Dave Dye, and this is someone, you know, who in Sydney, Australia, you're looking through all the DNADs and the books and you see his name everywhere, and then all of a sudden, you know, a few years later, are lucky enough to be able to work with someone like that for a couple of months. It was just amazing. Extraordinary. And then, of course, probably the year and a half, 2 years in, then Juan did the balls, and you know, and then the rest everyone knows about. He just kind of couldn't put a foot wrong and was just doing all this great stuff. And I think that, you know, if we're talking about agencies, once you get that momentum and that energy and that aura, it helps everyone else in the agency. You have kind of this invisible kind of force, which is, you know, in the air, I guess, which makes it a lot easier. You know, you once that happened, you know, you're selling the stuff, the first things you present, you're getting clients which are having much better conversations, not any newer ones who have come in for that type of stuff, but even the older ones who go, well, okay, well, maybe we need to be thinking differently and more put more pressure on ourselves to do that. And then all the creatives in the department, and I think that's probably the thing I kind of believe, is that I think everyone's talented in that department, whether or not they do certain types of work or that's kind of irrelevant, because you need that whole support organism of everyone doing their own thing, because it's nothing gets created in a vacuum, you know, like nothing I did was solely because of me. You've got to, you know, it all goes down to the finest micro kind of element when you're in agencies that have that kind of determination and that momentum. So it's definitely something around the aura and the phenomenon of creative departments that I really enjoy and I really see the value in. And that was very, very live, Alan. And then, yeah, I just started to, you know, and again, I think for some reason I quite enjoyed pitching. I kind of enjoyed client meetings. So I think they saw a bit of that and gave me bits more and more of that. And until eventually I think, you know, I was doing quite a lot of that, and almost my relationship with Rich then, because Andy left, you know, before that, had gotten a lot better, and I kind of worked out and cracked the code. And so, you know, he was even getting me to you know, contribute to who we hired and things like that. So I was never, again, it was never, I was always interested in less the TV ads, more the kind of what I guess what today we'd call integrated stuff. Or, you know, I was also CDing for Hyper, which was in Fallon, which was more at that time the digital stuff. So within 3 years, I guess I kind of found myself doing quite a lot of things there, but never really, you know. I think the sad thing is a lot of the stuff I would have thought I would have loved to have made, I know this is the case for everyone, just didn't, for whatever reason, just didn't get over the edge. And but, you know, I was also blessed that, you know, lucky enough that some of the things I thought, oh yeah, that's interesting to me, you know, everyone at Fallon would support and make, even if, you know, sometimes even if they didn't particularly like it themselves. I guess go on.
I was only going to ask, I think the campaign possibly that you're best known for from that time is the Natural Confectionery Company. Is that the name of the sweet thing?
Yeah.
I mean, was that towards the end or the middle, or at what point during your Fallon time was that, and how did that come about?
I think that was probably in the middle. I think I did a lot of stuff in the middle like that, and you know, cheese strings. I don't mind. I mean, it kind of eventually got pulled off there, but yeah. I mean, again, the National Confectionery Company. Again, I like that stuff. It's not the stuff I would think I was, you know, it was going to change the world. But you know, that's just a case of, you know, that brief was you know, we want to talk to mums and kids at the same time, literally. And we wrote a whole bunch of scripts, and there was Richard got in a guy called Dirk Van Doren, who's a really good art director who used to run Tomato. And so we just wrote a whole bunch of scripts, and then I think that at that time the Gorilla had already been made, and I think everything else, every other Cadbury brief that went into system got to see the benefit of that. So you know, Phil Rumble, the client there, also very good. I remember presenting them to the marketing director and the brand manager, and they started, you know, arguing over words here or phrases there. And then I think Phil just sort of said, well, no, that, you know, let's just make them use this as a bit of an experiment and just see what happens in a meeting. And then, you know, the next kind of month we're making them. So I think that yeah, that was kind of in the middle. And then I kind of had a good run in just in terms of, I mean, Fallon was so busy that you know, you'd write ads and you'd be so busy on one shoot, you wouldn't get to go on another one. And I don't know whether other people experienced that, but it was probably 1 year shortly after that where, you know, I didn't go on 4 shoots because we were just that busy. So I was on other shoots for other things. So other people, we had to hire people actually to go on shoots and things. So, you know, there's just that amount of work running through the system. And then like every other, unfortunately, you know, great place, that the life cycle, then something, I don't know what happens, but something seems to, you know, feel a bit different. And so a few years, well, probably only a year after that, maybe a year and a half, something different was different in the waters, I guess. And that was probably the start. If you speak to anyone, that people sort of go, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm just not sure. We're just not hitting home runs as much anymore. And, you know, at that time I had, I'd worked with Jonathan Trimble and Tim a couple of times, but Jonathan had always wanted to start an agency. And I wasn't sure what I was doing. I think I obviously wanted to go to the States, so I was kind of entertaining that kind of stuff. But Jonathan one night just had dinner with me and said, oh, would you ever start your own agency? And I kind of said, oh, I've done it before, I'm not sure, depend. And so we just started talking, and then it just kind of evolved, just kind of, well, how would you see it? And I said, like this, how would you see it? And I know he had formed other kind of combinations and they'd fallen through, which I think happens a lot. And then we just had, you know, started talking about what would be the point of it, like what would we want to achieve? And we agreed, you know, we do want it to be a lifestyle agency. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just not something, you know, we wanted to do something that would make some kind of dent, I guess, and grow rather than just kind of sustain a lifestyle. We wanted it to be creatively focused. And the great thing about JT is he understands creativity but also creative people. And I think that's kind of a key thing for any CEO, I guess, of a creative agency, if you're going to have one, is that to understand that and then to respect the tram lines that everyone has. So we kind of discussed what those clear tram lines would be and kind of promised that we'd never kind of cross over those because, you know, I'd seen before the blurring of those lines is when some things start to become problematic. And then there was a lot of talk around new models, and digital and integrated then. And, you know, we thought, okay, we want to do that more interesting type of work, but also you can't just throw away, you know, the whole history of advertising in the past and invent this new thing, because I think there's that quote or a quote, there are two kinds of fools, one who says this is old and therefore not good and one who says this is new and therefore better. And we kind of thought, well, we want to keep, you know, there's all these great learnings, and which is one of the reasons I think it's great you're doing a podcast, but all these great learnings that are useful and great people that are useful around. And also, obviously, we want to be future-facing. So we wanted a bit of a mix of both of that. So we just discussed around, you know, what that would look like and how, what kind of things those would be. So, you know, like in the first couple of years, you know, I sent the creatives that we had to Mary Weir and Paul Belford, and, you know, because I thought, well, those people are much more experienced than me and also have something to contribute. Then we had people like Paul Feldwick who would come in once a month, and, you know, I'd talk to Steve Henry quite a lot. So we just thought that that's a very important structural part of what we wanted. And then, you know, of course, naming's always an issue, isn't it, when
you've got
a name. So.
Yeah.
So, and at that point, yeah, then Tim decided to come on board, because there's always a period where people are kind of in and out, not sure. So then we decided to do it. We knew naming would be an issue, so we said we're just going to decide, we'll write a bunch up, we're just going to decide on one day, and we're just going to have to live with whatever we go with. good or bad. And then we started, and we didn't, I mean, I probably wouldn't recommend this, but we didn't have a client. The other thing, which I guess it might be useful to anyone that's thinking about doing it, we also agreed that it had to be bootstrapped. So, i.e. that our salaries would have to be low, and even if we did have money, we wouldn't spend it on paying ourselves a lot or on extravagant things, because I think you've got to starve a bit and have a bit of that pressure in the tank to be able to motivate you and push you and get a different kind of momentum within a place. So we all agreed that it would be very tightly bootstrapped.
And were you starting in premises, or were you just in the kitchen of one of you, or how bootstrapped were you?
Yeah, we just sort of started in our own kind of flats. We then flew over to New York to go speak to a number of people like Dave Joger and that, and just to get any bits of wisdom of that we could. We came back, and then I think Chris Clancy, who runs Zone, said, we've got a little office on Ganton Street, like a tiny one that we moved out of, and I still got the lease, and there's another 4 or 5 months on it. So if you want to go in there, it's above the Shaston pub, you can. So we thought, oh, yeah, great. That's amazing, a bit of luck. So then we all moved in there, got some computers, sat down, then just really didn't know what to do. we didn't have a new business strategy, which we, in hindsight, probably wasn't a good thing. But like, again, like every these things, I think, you know, action brings magic and power. And I think, you know, you need the conditions to be right. And a client that we'd had at Fallon had left there and gone to Freeview, Tim, and he said, oh, I'm putting it up for pitch. Do you want to pitch for it? And I also, he actually was in a bit of trouble. He needed a Christmas campaign because he was in between agencies. So we said, yeah, of course. So we did, there was kind of two beats. We did that and pitched for it. And then lucky enough, we won it. So that was our first client. And then Selfridges kind of followed shortly after that.
How did you get Selfridges?
That was a pitch.
Just to rewind a little bit. I mean, when you and Jonathan got together and you, what did you feel like you needed to have to begin the agency in terms of people who were there? Because some people go, you need a suit with a Rolodex of client contacts. You need a planner, a creative, and a suit. You need a finance person. Do you need a finance person? So what did you set up with, and did you follow anyone's path in that way?
Jonathan had JT had done a lot of the work anyway. So, I mean, he had some forecasting, some numbers, some rough numbers in there. We went and spoke to some people that had done it themselves successfully and got their advice. But the kind of rough shape was in the beginning, that because Jonathan is extremely passionate person around creativity and creative people, and that I will say. And so the rough shape was we wanted to over-index on creative people, and that was a conscious decision. We didn't have any discussions around a finance director. We thought we were just going to outsource all that. And in hindsight, we probably should have spent more time looking at that. And we knew we had to have a planner just because the way we wanted to grow and the types of clients we wanted to get, that would have to be a function of the agency. So it was that, and with the rough shape that when we grow, we want to have more creative people in the agency than anyone else. So planning light, if you like, very mm-hmm. light. I mean, still to this day, it's extremely planning light and creative heavy. The amazing thing about Jonathan is he supports that, you know, even if it doesn't sometimes make financial sense. And I just mean in terms of, you know, number of creative head hours against a piece of business. But we would argue that I think that's more interesting and effective than perhaps having a planner and an account manager and a project manager and, say, two creatives on a piece of business. So that was the rough shape. And then with all these things, you kind of you make decisions, which is important, but then have to adapt, make decisions, then adapt around it. And then you get into it's such an intense deep learning curve in the first couple of years. You don't even really, even though obviously we all want to do good work, you know, whatever that is, and even to us, whatever good work is, but that stuff, the concrete's not set then, you know. So it's not that that stuff takes a back seat, but there's just so much going on in such a compressed amount of time that you almost want to get the other stuff bedded in first before you even start looking at the work, because, you know, otherwise it's quite a big jumble and a bit of a mess. I don't know if that answers your question, Ben.
I think it does. And I think there are so many questions and so many variables when you begin a process like this in a situation like this. And I think aside from how you decide to make it up in a somewhat different way, what did you think that you were doing that was maybe different to what other people were doing? And having been in this position, what do you think got you on pitch lists and interested from people who wanted an agency?
Yeah, so the things that I wanted to do, and it was purely a personal thing, was I just wanted to create a structure that would work for me, just knowing what I'd known, working at all the places I'd known. Because I think, you know, we're all a product of the agencies we've worked in, and I think I wanted to take the best of that and then whatever made sense for me in times of working every day. So I didn't want dilution, because I just didn't understand. Like, you'd go to a meeting with a client, they'd do their hour brief, it'd go back into a planner, he'd spend a couple of days, it'd then go into a team, it'd have their own take on it, and back to the CD. So one of the things I just, and, you know, I'm not saying any of these things are good or bad, but they just suited me, was we never have briefs, and still to this day I don't think they do. So we just had briefings. So as soon as we'd come back from a meeting, we'd brief the whole agency, regardless if you're working on it or not, and not because, you know, great ideas can come from anywhere, but just so it was in the back recesses of people's minds in case something happened. And we still do that because dilution was a big thing for me. Traffic was another thing, which, you know, I love traffic people. They're some of the best people I know. But again, I didn't think that was a necessary component for what we needed, because I thought traffic should really be the job of the CD. So I took on that role because I wanted to cast and decide who worked on stuff, and I wanted to be aware of everything that was going through the agency. So that was another thing that we stopped. The next thing was probably the way we worked with planners. So there's, you know, I mean, we called it prototyping because we have to call it something that clients could get their heads around, but it was really just doing stuff in tandem rather than in silos. So, you know, all going away, coming back. So I would work with Tim or Rob Ward, who's an excellent planner, and we'd just constantly be discussing stuff, because, I mean, I don't know if it was similar for you with Luna. Invariably, when you get briefed from a client or there's a problem, the kind of senior people, the people on it, can come to some really good conclusions quite quickly. You know, in a short space of time, you kind of have hunches and and, you know, I think the difference between, you know, good people and great people is really, you know, speed and obviously experience. So I always thought, well, okay, we need to keep that kind of exchange going between the planner and the creatives, and we're creatively driven. So more often than not, it would be, well, I've got this thought, I think it's quite interesting. How could you shape something around that? How that makes sense, you know. And sometimes it worked the other way, but so we had this kind of prototyping thing. And then probably the most thing, which everyone might find controversial, I mean, I don't think it is, was I didn't really want to have set married teams that kind of would work together solely together forever. Just because my own experience at Fallon was it didn't have to be that way, and I've got to thank them for that. And also, I thought, you know, in my experience, more often than not, there was always one driver that was more kind of had more drive than the other. And I wanted to try and think about the whole department in terms of casting rather than set teams. And it's not that I don't like people working together. Of course, that's a great thing. So I thought, we'll just hire individuals and we'll mix and match them and pair them up and they can work with me or whoever they want. And we'll just kind of get rid of this idea of this set team, especially against these newer outputs. I mean, everyone knows our time's compressed now to think of ideas. Everyone knows, you know, which is a tragedy, by the way. But we all know that the outputs are different. And I think the outputs for a writer and an art director and a team, you know, even in 10, 15 years ago, did make sense and you got stuff out. But the landscape's changed so much now. I just think in terms of speed and efficiency, and also the type of ideas, I was just more interested in to see what would happen when different combinations came together. We made the decision not to ever hire teams, but it was never a decision that we said we'd stick to. I mean, we have. We said if it doesn't make sense and we can't get on pitch this, we'll change it, or our work suffering will change it. So that they're kind of some of the fundamental things we changed. You know, I don't think they're revolutionary. We were definitely not the first to do them, but they were just things that made sense to me and Jonathan and Tim. And then the next thing, getting on pitch lists, I think what I will say about when we did pitch, it was always against bigger agencies, probably 80% of the time. And I think because we had probably had a bit of, I mean, I don't know, I'd probably have to ask clients, but you're always either the wild card or the more interesting option. Hmm. And I don't think if you're on pitches and you're the wild card, it's almost impossible to win. I mean, never happens, but if you're the interesting option, I think you've got a chance. I mean, you know, taking away all the political issues that come with pitches and the noise, which you've kind of got to flush early. We managed to get on really big pitch lists just, I think, by being interesting. And I think that, you know, being interesting is different from, you know, we're winning lots of awards or, you know, we've got, you know, creative techs in every department. I think it was definitely interesting in terms of the way we work with clients, I think, was different perhaps to the other agencies on the list.
Right. And what I find is also kind of interesting, and this is what sort of happened with Luna, is I think the autonomy of being sort of in charge is quite intoxicating, and it's both very pleasant but I think quite challenging too. How did you find, because if you're saying things like we should really make it creative heavy and planning light and things like that, there's responsibility for that combination working that's kind of on your shoulders a little bit. Did you feel that was a positive or negative or just energizing or what?
Yeah, I think a mixture of all those things. But I think probably the thing to note is you can get carried away with a lot of your own bullshit, you know. And I think one of the things that, you know, we eventually got good at was checking in on that. Because while I think there's a lot of great stuff that can come from everyone drinking the Kool-Aid, and I actually think that's important. I think if you're going to start something and build something, it should be its own thing. It should be a thing where, you know, that is a bit cultish, and I don't mean that in the negative sense of the word. I mean that, you know, you're all doing this thing. You're in it together. You're creating something. You're all riding that wave of momentum. But then there are times when, yeah, I think you do get a bit of ahead of yourself. You become a little bit arrogant. Probably unjustifiably so, or you get a bit lost, or you're just not aware of what stage life cycle you are in the agency. And I think that's kind of one of the more interesting things maybe to look at is, you know, and not that I want to codify life cycles of agencies because, you know, it may not be possible, but there are definitely some distinct moments in time in any agencies that, if you're not aware of, in terms of knowing what to do in those times, it can cost you quite dearly.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by one of those times?
Yeah, so there's a book called Predictable Success, but there's, you know, they talk about the success of things. You've got what's called an early struggle. You've got the fun bit. You've got then what they call whitewater, and then you've got this period of what success is. And then it kind of goes into like a treadmill, a big run, and then the death rattle, and that's when an agency kind of dies. And I think just if you take the early struggle, which is actually intoxicating, that's when you're all at the pub, you know, it's great. And then that goes into fun. In that fun time, it can be so distracting because you're almost not focusing on why you started the agency. You're focusing on just enjoying the things that you're enjoying in that time. So for us, we wanted to grow at a certain rate and get a certain type of clients. And in that fun stage, it was really tempting to go, well, you know what? Well, maybe we just don't do that and just, you know, stay here. Because if this is what it's going to be like forever, that's pretty good, isn't it? Because we're all having, you know, having fun. And then, and if you're not aware of that, I think that could actually change the direction of the course of the agency. And similarly in Whitewater, which is a really tough patch, which is probably, you know, the time between us winning, you know, Love Film and Nationwide, where it gets a bit tricky, right? Because you've hired maybe, say, 12, 14 people against a base which is kind of just breaking even, really. And you may have made a few impulsive decisions in between then just because, you know, that's what you do. It's very tempting then to think, well, this isn't working. And, you know, humans are really fragile, sensitive people, and you can instantly go from, well, you know, this is good, just let it be, to, oh, this isn't working, maybe I should be looking elsewhere, or maybe this is the wrong formation, or, you know, these are all just very human things which can have very impactful consequences if you don't check in with each other or if you're not aware what stage you're in. And I think a lot of people, you know, maybe this is 2 years in, 2.5 years in, actually give up in that Whitewater or whatever you want to call it phase, because it just all seems too hard. You can't, it all seems, the world seems against you, you know, no one's talking about you, or you're not making the impact you wanted to do. And I think, you know, one of the things I heard a long time ago was it takes 6 years to build an overnight success. So I just kept reminding myself of that, and, you know, we kind of got through that. So
did you have,
I
like
think
a,
you're right.
I just wondered, did you have a kind of North Star to always refer to and guide you in terms of what you were trying to achieve that would maybe get you through those times?
In terms of another agency?
Well, more like, I mean, say you had, I mean, we didn't really go into the exact reasons why you set up, but, you know, some people will go, well, we're going to do this for 5 years, then sell out to a holding company, or we're going to do this because it's going to, you know, revolutionize, you know, certain kinds of advertising or certain ways of operating, and we're going to be the people who change it all, like Hal Henry, I think, you know, the way that they operated. Did you have a thing you were always trying to do and were able to refer back to?
Yeah, I think we never set it up to sell, and I think if someone wants to do that, you know, and that, I'm not judging that at all, and I think you can do that. There's a different way to set up, is what I would say, if you are setting up to eventually sell, which is not what we did. We wanted to just set up because we honestly thought we could do things better, and we wanted to make a creative dent into the world, so to speak. So whatever that was, we wanted to be famous for pushing the creative agenda in general. So that's kind of what it was that we're doing. And I guess the North Star for us is, you know, is this a place where creative people want to come and work? Because in my head, if it could become that, if it did become that, if people really, really wanted to work there, then that was kind of almost half the mission for me, rather than just be another place that's kind of either in the weeds or, you know, just kind of trudging along. And again, you know, I don't disrespect those places because everyone serves a purpose to everything. But, you know, our ambition was just not to be that. We wanted to be a creative destination and hopefully get people from all over the world wanting to come and work there.
And did you have a because I know that, you know, you grew up with the son of a Montessori teacher, and was there a wider sense of purpose to what you were doing, or did something like that come about through? Because I think when you're running a company and you do have the ability to do things in a certain way that could be contributing in a wider sense to society. Did you ever feel like that was something that was happening to you?
Yeah, that changed. That took about midway through, we kind of all sat down and thought, you know, and also the personal crosses the private. So many, I'm sure you've experienced as well. So many times in these things, and we kind of sat down and thought, you know, what are we really doing here? And I kind of said, well, the thing I enjoy the most, and being brutally honest, is just seeing people grow. Like, honestly, just seeing talent come up, seeing people grow in whatever form that is and achieve things they didn't think they could. And, you know, it was quite a powerful thing. So then we thought, well, maybe this idea of human potential, if everyone that came in, we could increase their potential by however much or by whatever metric, then as a side effect, maybe the work and what we're doing becomes more interesting. So our focus kind of shifted to that halfway through, about increasing everyone's human potential, and we put some things in place structurally that would do that. And again, these things are very difficult actually in reality to do, like, you know, in terms of giving everyone shares or finding out what they really want to achieve in life, really, and then trying to support that. And they can also be distractions. So again, it's just such a contrast between that. But we thought, well, let's increase as much as we can everyone's potential as a human. We've got people here that have been here since the day we started, and most of the agency is that. There's something we all love about it. So we cut the kind of bigger purpose of it. Did shift to that, and, you know, kind of doing more interesting good things, I guess.
And was that a sort of unanimous thing from all of you? Because I guess it's interesting when you're, you know, however many of you trying to make that decision together. And, you know, I'd say one of the worst things anyone could do in setting up is having people with disparate aims and ambitions for what you're trying to achieve, because eventually they'll start having friction with each other and you won't achieve any of them. But did you feel like, because you set up with the right people in the first place, that wasn't an issue?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, and it's interesting you brought that up, because midway through, Tim's vision of what that wanted to be was different. And that's just a reality. Because, you know, agendas aren't often stated, they're revealed, right? So,
yeah.
It's, and that just, you can't predict that. You've just got to let that occur. So, which was fine. So we just had a conversation, and Tim decided that, you know, and we decided out Jonathan, my vision was perhaps not exactly the same as where Tim wanted to take it. And, you know, we kind of just got on our way, and Tim went off and did something else. So you're absolutely right. I would say, the best you can, if you're going to start an agency, the best you can flush out that stuff. It's so important. You know, you can't do it to the full extent, but the best you can, and then understanding everyone's tram lines and making sure they are in place. I think those things are, as you say, they're very important. And, you know, trust is quite a big thing. You know, you need to trust, because, again, we're all humans, and there are things built within us sometimes that, you know, in facing self-survival, we kind of save ourselves before the bigger picture. So it's just understanding all that stuff is critical.
Sure.
And then I was just thinking, even random things, like, you know, you learn, like, we all do these things where we say what works in scope, but, and one of the things that was really helpful for us was just listing to clients what was out of scope, you know, just a simple shift in that thing. And maybe everyone does it, but it changed our agency, you know, because we weren't doing that.
Yeah. Without wanting to get into any kind of vulgarity here, I think the financial side of things is quite interesting too, because, like you said, you started in a bootstrapped way. Was there a point where you were, I wouldn't say awash with money, or did it stop being an issue, or was it always kind of hovering in the background as a kind of imperative to some of the decisions you made?
Yeah, it was. So there was a period, again, probably the third, into the third year, where we were doing pretty well and, you know, financially speaking. And at that point, and I'm sure other people tell you this, you kind of go, well, what decision do we make here? Do we invest to get bigger? Or do we just kind of sit it out and see what happens? So we decided to invest. So, we made some big hires, and we're getting onto all these pan-European pitch lists. I mean, not winning them, because invariably the question that came back, and anyone starting up will get this, is were questions around size,
yeah,
and capability, which we all know is a totally irrational, in a way, question, because no one's got 20 people ready to work on them, and there are systems and that in place now where you can handle pieces of business and you hire people. But I'm sure, I don't know if you found it, Luna, that any time you had a good answer for that question, the irrationally of clients' brains is they actually do need to walk into a bigger building where there's just more people, you know? And we got that a lot, like, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, who knows, but, you know, if we were bigger, would we have won? I don't know. So we were just getting kicked back, so we thought, okay, we have to get bigger. And that strange thing, because we didn't then win at the rate and targets, you know, we set ourselves targets that we thought we would. So then you are in a very precarious position where you've hired people against business you haven't won. You're probably over-servicing an existing client base. And, you're trying to find other revenue streams or think about it, and all of a sudden you're like, well, we could probably go another 6 months at this, but then we really need to win something. So the financial side does dictate, quite a lot in certain phases of the business. So we, luckily, I think we won House of Fraser and then Allianz and things like that. So we were okay in the end. But that period, I think, yeah, you do find yourself making, you have to make a decision, really. I think if your goal is to keep growing.
Sure. And so what has the kind of story been in terms of the growth and your continued involvement in 18Feet?
So I'm not part of it any longer. It's obviously still going. So we grew it to where we wanted it, I guess to a certain extent. And that was kind of the sixth year. This group called Creston kind of knocked on the door and said, we don't have a note agency, we'd like to have one. We spoke to them, sold them a bit of share, because again, Jonathan and I wanted to not have this reason that we were being told, whether it was the real one or not, why we weren't converting on some pretty big pieces of business. So we thought if we align ourselves with someone that has all these other functions, like, you know, PR, social, digital, whatever, that we would start winning, it would just be left to the work then. So that's the reason we did that, and that was about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And at that time, I was kind of just really exhausted and tired and frustrated, you know, because I'm not sure if you've had this, but it's near never. No matter what happens, it's kind of like, I don't know, like awards or drugs. No time's as good as the first time. So you're kind of like, yeah, maybe we have achieved something, but it's just, in my head, it just wasn't going at the same momentum and rate. And I was getting frustrated that, you know, maybe we weren't doing as much interesting stuff that I wanted to do. And, you know, the landscape was kept changing even more. And I was just seeing things in meetings, and clients were, you know, doing things which I'm sure everyone that listens to your podcast has experienced. And I just thought, I don't know. So I had a bit of a, don't know if I can, hand on heart, keep putting in as much as I could, and it might be time for someone else to see if they can shift this in a new direction. And so I just chatted to JT. I came back here to think about it, and then we just thought, well, yeah, if I'm not into it and I've got other stuff going on, then it's not a good place for anyone in that agency. So, which is kind of went our own ways. And, you know, it's only the 6 years, so I'm kind of probably being contradictory to my take 6 years to be an overnight success. But, so I just, you know, we separated our ways, but with no ill feeling. And I hope they do well. So it's now part of Creston and that group. And, you know, I hope they do start winning some of that stuff, which we just couldn't seem to get over the edge on in the end.
And what, if anything, do you think you most took out of that experience, either in the starting up or the eventual sort of running of a creative department, and that you might maybe take into something else or a final lesson for somebody who's listening to this?
I think, yeah, it's probably a couple of things. I think it, and they're just not going to sound that new, but I think the first thing would be to always try and get absolute clarity between you and your partners as much as you can. And that may mean the way that you currently communicate or think you communicate, there may be a better way. So someone might be able to facilitate that better. So we had a couple of people that allowed us to talk to each other in ways where everything came out. Because I think a lot of things that go unexpressed can eventually impact on any kind of startup or business. And these things need to be talked about and worked through. I think the biggest learning with 18 feet is this constant relationship between cash flow, money, forecasting, you know, operating profit, and your intended goal, and you know, i.e. the work. If you know, it's not either or, it's actually and. But the and is the real difficult bit, because what I would say is there have to be times when you over-index on investing in risks and work and things, impulsive things. And then there has to be periods of quite practical, sobering, you know, focus around the money. And it has to oscillate between those two, I think. That's my learning, without being irresponsible on either. And that's where you do need a good financial person that understands what you're trying to achieve creatively, but also ensures that you, because sometimes creative people can be more irresponsible, but not irresponsible on the cash flow side and the cash side. So if you can find someone to do that role and not outsource, so my experience with outsourcing it is it just doesn't work, because if you want to start something with a culture and a creative culture, and the culture gives energy to the agency, if that person is not in that culture, they'll never understand it. Therefore, the decisions that sometimes you're going to want them to make or not make are made in the abstract or not at all. Mm-hmm. So if you can invite that person into your culture, and it, you know, it could only be 2 or 3 days a week, but it can't be like a lot of ways of going. You could outsource all your business functions, actually, financially. I don't think that works. So that would be the biggest thing. And I just believe when the, you know, hire slow, fire early. Yeah. It is actually a big thing because if you don't do that, that again has consequences that affect everyone. So, and then the only other thing we made a big effort to do was to talk back to the agency, present back to the agency every, you know, on regularities, probably every 2 or 3 months, about what was going on. Because I think it may sound like a small thing, but it's really important, because, you know, I know myself when I've been in agencies and you're not getting any feedback, or you're not understanding what's going on in a bigger picture or around, it becomes really frustrating. And just simply informing people, feeding back to them, updating them with regularity has quite a powerful effect, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's funny, there's a website here called Glassdoor where people explain what it's like working at whatever, you can look up whatever company and you'll get people probably anonymously talking about where they are. And the biggest gripe of all is we're not included in, you know, not bigger conversations, but nobody in management ever tells us what's going on. And I think that's an interesting balance because, you know, you don't necessarily want to tell everybody everything that's going on all the time, because that can actually be quite damaging depending on what circumstances you're going through. But at the same time, I think that there's way too much kind of secrecy about the bits and pieces that are going on, and people just want to feel like that you've respected them enough to include them, I think, is one of the things. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, that's quite interesting. I have to look that up, that glass door. But yeah, I agree 100%.
Cool. Well, I think we've gone through things quite thoroughly. This was a sort of slight you episode and slightly the whole startup thing. So thanks very much for giving us both of those aspects of your career so far. I think, what I'm finding fascinating so far in having all these chats about people starting up is that no two stories are the same, yet there are common threads you can find in where people succeed and fail. So thanks so much for contributing to that, for not me necessarily, but for anyone else who happens to be listening.
No, thank you. And I think it's great, you know, as I said, that you're doing this, because I think if someone can take one thing out of it, I think that could be helpful. That's a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll let you get back to whatever is going on in Sydney right now. If it was about lunchtime or something, I guess, or coming up.
Yeah, just lots of people with activewear drinking. It's probably like LA, drinking shakes and stuff. So
There's a lot of that over here, yeah. Great. Well, thanks again, Matt. And let's speak
soon.
Thanks,
Ben. Okay. Anytime.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?